Sweet, so let's go 20. With the understanding that the mic will by 1 o'clock.
This is 45 minutes.
Yeah, but that's what we're going for. Okay. The mic is on.
This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing, Monday, March 4th, 2013. The time is 10 after 12. All right, Senate file. We do have a quorum? We have a quorum present. So with that, Senate file 706, Senator Hayden is going to be approaching the table soon. And I don't feel like this mic is on.
Not either.
Is it on? Would you speak into your microphone so I can see if it works?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yours is working great. Okay, Senator Hayden on Senate File 706. I just would like to talk to all. We have a number of bills today. We also have a number of people requesting to hear on the various bills. I will be very tight with you in terms of your testimony in order for us to move this agenda forward today. And the reason that that's important for all of you to know is that our delay in being able to be succinct and not repeat what other people have said really endangers our capacity to hear other bills that are waiting to be heard in this committee. We have an enormous number of bills from here on out till the deadline. So I will be pretty tight with you asking to make sure that the testimony speaks specifically to the legislation and hopefully not too much about the history of the universe. Okay, with that, Senator Hayden, would you begin?
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move Senate File 706. And I maybe we'll ask Ms. Magadance what the next stop is. I'm not sure.
The next stop is finance.
Finance. So I'd move Senate File 706 to be passed and referred to finance.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 706 be passed and referred to finance on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 706 is regarding a Hennepin County project that they launched that we've heard a little bit about. The pilot, Hennepin Health, integrates the services and abilities of our county health resources, Metropolitan Health Plan, HCMC, and its eight clinics, North Point Health and Wellness Center, a federally qualified health center, and our county human service and public health departments. The pilot is designed as a healthcare delivery network to serve the unique needs of the most challenging, costly segments of the county's safety net population. Hennepin Health in its first year has demonstrated success in reducing emergency room visits, reducing prescription drug cost, and improving medication compliance, reducing administrative duplication, and creating communication and service linkages to public health, social service, and housing that supports and integrates our clients and community living. We bring Senate File 706 in order to create opportunities for Hennepin Health to increase enrollment by lifting the cap on enrollment and by allowing Hennepin Health to negotiate with DHS to serve other segments of the MA population who can benefit from this integrated care delivery network. Increasing enrollment will help the pilot sustain its administrative infrastructure necessary to support the pilot's efficiency. Madam Chair, we do have one of our testifiers that's here that will also help you walk through the bill a little bit.
Well, thank you, Senator Hayden. Jennifer DeKubelitz, Area Director, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. This is not working.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators.
Be sure to introduce yourself each time you speak.
Jennifer DeKubelitz with Hennepin County. I'm here to talk about the Hennepin Health Project, and thank you for the time today. We will make it brief. What we are looking to do is we have launched Hennepin Health as of last January of 2012, and in the past year we have moved over 30 initiatives which have demonstrated two objectives. One is to improve the outcomes of the residents we serve. The second is to do it for less dollars, so reducing costs as well as improving health outcomes. In year one, we had substantial learnings. I'll give you a couple of examples where we have individuals, and this is system-wide, of seeing individuals in the emergency department. In month one, we found that we had a large volume of folks in the emergency department for dental care. Traditional health care, you get an ED charge, you prescribe pain medications for a highly chemically dependent population, you refer them to a dentist for a population where transportation is often of issue, and we wonder why we see them back in 3-4 days with the reoccurring issue. What Hennepin Health was able to identify is that the system is broken. We're not meeting the needs of this low-income population. We're serving 6,200 Medicaid expansion recipients. And what we were able to do within a matter of days was mobilize the system to create same-day access to dental care, to reduce costs, get better immediate outcomes for the health of our population. We have done over 30 such initiatives in the first year, and it's been a tremendous amount of effort and work for our population, serving 1% of the population under this demonstration project. What we're looking to do with this bill is expand the ability to look at other populations. So for Medicaid expansion, some of the needs are very unique. We're putting solutions in place. We are continuing to build those solutions and get them on the ground and watching to make sure it's for lower cost. And we are looking to say, what are the needs of our families and children, our disabled populations, because there will be unique challenges to the system of where the system isn't working for those individuals. So what this bill seeks to do is to take away the cap of enrollees that we can expand. Again, getting a system our size as attention around 1% of the population is a challenge. We've had early successes. We've been able to demonstrate we can reduce costs. We are looking to increase those numbers as well as look at other populations so we can identify where are we falling short as a healthcare system in meeting the needs of additional populations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer.
This is your first hearing, so this would be an author's amendment?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Do we have a copy of the amendment, or is it a... We have copies of the amendment. Could we have those distributed,
please? I
guess
they're making the actual copy of the amendment, Madam.
Do you want to explain the amendment while it's being distributed?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'd like to amend the bill, page 1, line 12. After the period, insert, the commissioner may designate additional individuals to enroll in Hennepin County pilot program by geographic area or based on enrollment in any other county programs who would benefit from an integrated county service model. Madam Chair, this is requested by the Department of Human Services.
Senator Hayden moves an author's amendment to Senate File 706. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Is there any further testimony, Senator Hayden, on the bill?
Madam Chair, I don't have any further testifiers. I don't know if there's others that want to testify to the bill.
Is there anyone else wishing to appear in front of the committee on Senate File 706? Seeing no one, I will move it to discussion from committee members. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, so basically the amendment, it sounds like a great bill, but the amendment is opening it up to statewide, basically, or do you still contained in, if you're, can you explain the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen,
Senator Hayden.
This was an amendment that DHS brought forward. It looks like it's still in both the counties. I don't know if there's someone from DHS that wanted some comfort language for this that could speak to the
Is there
the
someone
issue.
From DHS that would like to speak to as why this amendment is necessary?
Jennifer Blanchard, Department of Human Services, Healthcare Administration.
Could you repeat your name? I'm sorry, we didn't get
Jennifer Blanchard.
Jennifer Blanchard. Thank
Senator
you, Jennifer.
Committee. The way the language is currently written, we have competitive bidding in the 7-county metro area that does not change that. So there is nothing in the current language that would allow an opportunity for Hennepin County to be provided with enrollees to increase their total number served. This allows us, if there's demonstrated need, to provide a population of people. Currently, the way the MAAX expansion population is attributed to Hennepin County is through an analysis where they look at individuals who are in their clinics, HCMC and the other clinics, and are able to identify the highest population of people within those clinics, and then those zip codes are used to auto-enroll people. So it is the assumption that if based on determination that there is another population who would benefit from this, it would likely be done in a similar manner and individuals would be auto-enrolled.
Thank you, Ms. Blanchard. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, so this will go to a budget finance, and so
yes.
that will be difficult to get a number around that if it's just an auto-enrolled. Not sure. I'm just thinking out loud here, but it's a interesting pilot project. I mean, but hard to get your hands around this.
Ms. Blanchard, are you able to, without us getting a fiscal note, we don't have that yet, but do you have a sense? Are you able to articulate for a fiscal note an assumption about what that would mean in terms of numbers for auto enrollment?
No, I can't at this time.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Nienau, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I don't see how this is a pilot program anymore if it covers the entire state and there's no sunset and there's no cap on enrollment. This becomes
state.
A new statewide policy. Am I misunderstanding something, Senator Hayden?
Yes, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, it's my understanding that I think that there was some miscommunication when we talked to you, when I answered Senator Rosen. It still only is a Hennepin County project. It is not a statewide project. The amendment doesn't change that.
So it continues to be a Hennepin County pilot project. It simply expands, takes off a cap of the number that you can serve and expands and gives flexibility in terms of adding additional programs. You have 30 now, but targeting special needs. Like you gave the example of dental care as being an obvious sort of frequent flyer situation in which somebody keeps circling around and is ineffectively dealt with. And so you put your arms around that and resolve that issue and create cost savings. You have 30 programs like that. This bill allows you to expand the number you can serve and the various kinds of programs that you can have. But it's still in the same geographic area. Is that correct? Is that an essential summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is a very good summary.
Senator Benson, further follow-up question?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, I don't see anywhere in here where the commissioner is limited in who they designate. And if they're going to auto-enroll, that means someone, you know, with an out-state zip code gets enrolled. I need more explanation from the department as to what auto-enroll means and if there are 30 existing programs. Are they state? How broad is this already reaching?
Ms. Blanchard?
Yes. Senator Benson, I just explained how the expansion population was determined. That does not indicate that is how this would happen into the future. This is very specific to Hennepin County, and if there were to be a Ramsey County pilot. Currently, there is only a Hennepin County pilot. And that would be only those that are in Hennepin County being served by Hennepin County programs. There's nothing in the way that the language is written that would allow somebody who is being served in another county to be a part of the pilot. The eligibility right now is only the MA expansion. So this allows all individuals who meet eligibility for our health care programs, who are residents of Hennepin County, who are in Hennepin County human service programs, to be potentially eligible for the program.
Senator Nienau.
Madam Chair, thank you. The a question I had was regarding reimbursement rates. As you mentioned, there's competitive bidding in the Seven County metro area. So how does that work if you take somebody into this program? Do you just take the rate that they would have normally had with whoever, whichever entity won that competitive bid, or how does that work?
Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon, Senator Nenow, Hennepin Health, for all intents and purposes, is an MCO and is contracted as an MCO and does not have any different rates associated with it.
Senator Nenow.
So does Hennepin County enter into the competitive bidding? Are you assigned your own rate? I'm unclear.
Madam Chair and Senator, we have not been. We applied as a part of the competitive bidding. That's currently not being rebid, and that is one of the challenges. We do not take any additional funds. We are doing this project for the same rate as the other health plans are receiving for the same population.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Hayden renews his motion to pass Senate File 706 as amended and refer to the Committee of Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Legislation passes. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. What's next? Senator Hayden,
good.
Senate File 704.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 704 be passed, and looks like it would be then referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
State.
It looks like state and local government first, Senator Hayden. So you would amend your...
Senate File 704 be passed and then referred to the Senate Local Government Committee.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 704 be passed and referred to state and local government. Please present the bill. Do you have any amendments to this bill at this time?
Not that I know of, okay. Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Excuse me. It appears there is an A1 amendment. It's included in your packets. Would you make sure Senator Hayden has a copy of this amendment?
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I would move and authors the A1 author's amendment.
Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 704, is it?
Yes.
704. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 704 implements the recommendations of last year's legislative audit report on child protection screening practices across the state. I have Rich Gilman here who will testify about the bill. We also have a number of letters of support that members should have. The bill would incorporate the Department of Human Service guidelines for child abuse and neglect into the statute so that they have the force of law. This bill will establish a work group to do two things. To do a feasibility study of a centralized state unit to screen all reports of alleged child maltreatment, address specific items identified by the Office of Legislative Auditors as needed clarification in the areas of standards and definitions of child abuse and neglect, screening practices and data collection and retention. Madam Chair, I have Rich Gierman from Safe Passages for Children that would like to testify.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Gierman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Rich Gierman, and I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, and we are a citizens group that is advocating for approved services to victims of child abuse and neglect in Minnesota, and thank you for the time to testify. I'll keep it brief. As the Senator said, this bill implements the recommendations in last year's legislative audit report on child protection screening practices. And I would say, big picture, in addition to improving safety and well-being for children in Minnesota, this bill will put in place some essential building blocks for the future so that we can begin to really talk more about evidence-based practices and quality outcomes for children, and really syncs with some of the other bills that you're hearing in terms of early childhood and children's mental health. So it's an important building block. And I want to say that in terms of, just let me characterize the report briefly and what it found and then how it connects to this bill. Last year, you may recall that the auditor did its report by taking 10 vignettes that represented typical reports that might come into a child protection screening worker. And then they went to workers around the state and asked them whether they would screen these cases in or screen them out. And so one of the scenarios, for example, represented an abuse, potential abuse case. It was about a father who was brandishing a gun and ultimately shot the child's pet in front of the child. In Minnesota, 45%, almost half of workers screened out that case. But it is probably about the clearest case that you will get of what is generally considered in practice to be terrorizing a child. That's in our statute. That's in our guidelines. If you look at the American Humane Association, their example of terrorizing is virtually the same as this. So this is an area where we're not operating consistently with our own standards or with generally accepted practices. Then on the neglect side, very briefly, they used a vignette in which there was a lack of food, and it was trying to find out what were the standards for lack of food. And what agency said that they always screen in cases where there's an allegation of insufficient food. And another agency said that they only screen in cases of that nature if the child's in the fifth percentile or lower of height and weight for their age. Well, clearly, by the time a child gets to that point, there's a lot of damage that's already been done, and that certainly isn't consistent with our state law or with generally accepted practices. Then in terms of stakeholder support or testimony, last year this committee heard from a number of stakeholders, and I won't try to repeat them all, but I'll just give you two brief examples. And I think these were persuasive to the committee that despite was really an overall kind of fairly positive report from the auditor, that there were some issues that needed to be worked on. In terms of older children, there was a woman who runs a program, a shelter for youth for Catholic Charities, who said that, it's virtually impossible to get kids over a certain age to be responded to by child protection. And that was really echoing a meeting that the legislative auditor had with about 45 youth workers from around the metro area and as far as St. Cloud, who said, in effect, that the cutoff age is middle school, 12, 13 years old, and at that point, kids are told to pick up and go find themselves a shelter. Again, this is not consistent with good practice or with state policy or law. And then finally, a worker from the Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery talked about an infant that they had reported numerous times to the county, kept getting screened out despite bruises and other signs. Finally, it was screened in. The family moved to another county, and within a short period, the child was dead. So those are some of the things that came out in testimony last year about the legislative auditor report. And then I'd just like to connect them briefly to the data findings. And the report, it said that some counties screen in reports of child abuse and keep quite a bit of data. Some keep virtually no data. Some collect the data and don't put it in the SSIS system. So what that means in practice is we can't see patterns of abuse and neglect over time in many cases, and that is required, again, by statute and by the guidelines. And it just means you can't manage the program because you don't have a basic idea of how many kids are coming into the system, how many times they're reported, whether they go to family assessment or not, whether they come back in the system. There are individual research reports done by counties and other people that show kids often are referred 5, 10, 15, I've heard as high as 25 times, but we don't have the data to really see that or where it's happening. So this legislation would essentially address these issues by three things. First, incorporating the department's guidelines for what counts as abuse and neglect into law so everybody's working with the same standards. Second, it authorizes a work group to take those areas that the auditor specifically identified and work them through down to the operational level so people have a better idea of what is abuse and neglect, and then to clarify what data needs to be collected and retained and put in the system. One other major piece of this that I want to mention is the work group would look at the feasibility of a centralized state child protection unit. The counties clearly have an understanding of their communities and so forth, but if you read the legislative audit report, we also can't stay where we are. So this group would look at a statewide centralized unit to screen in these reports. We can look at other states and see how they're doing this and come back to you in November with a report. I guess in sum, I would say the good news is this is really very doable. if the state and stakeholders and the counties work together, we can come back with some significant improvements to the system that aren't going to add, you know, big dollars by themselves to the process and aren't that difficult to implement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gurman. Senator Hayden, we have a couple other names on our list here. Do you have others that you were inviting?
This is good for me, Madam Chair.
I think the counties wanted to.
She'll bring them up.
Okay, great. Stacy Hennen from Grant County is here to testify. And that will be followed by Kristen Borsheim from DHS.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time.
We can't hear it, so if you can pull that up and see if it's going to work for you, it'd be great.
Okay. How's that?
It's like mine.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. I'm Stacy Hennen. I'm the director of Grant County Social Services, and I'm also the chair of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Agencies, County Social Services Administrators Children's Committee. Last year, the Office of the Legislative Auditor assessed the issue of child protection screening, and in doing that, they completed a thorough assessment, and they considered all aspects of child protection screening, both at the state and at the county level. The OLA produced a report that both counties and the counties and the state felt was well done, and they're using to define practice for the future. The formation of a task force to do what has already been done and is in process of being done would seem duplicative at this point. Of those things already completed and implemented is a new training system for child welfare staff. The department has also completed and is implementing a new training program for child welfare supervisors, and these trainings have a variety of different delivery methods and have proven to be quite effective. It's concerning that this bill proposes not only looking at centralized intake, but in fact requires any recommendation other than that to be justified. Minnesota has long been a state that is proactive and preventative in nature. That's demonstrated through a variety of programs that the counties do in collaboration with the state. These programs are individualized by each county's resources, needs, and knowledge of local dynamics and culture. Removing child protection intakes from the county removes the first gateway to those services and makes us a state that really doesn't get involved until the issue is serious and requires child protection intervention. If a call comes to the county and does not meet the screening criteria and is screened out, counties now can offer a variety of programs like parent support outreach, children or adult mental health services, child welfare services, and developmental disability services. Intake can be the gateway to a variety of services. Child protection services, by their nature, are about meeting a minimum level of care. We have many other services and resources that are offered to families who need assistance so they can reach an optimal level of care. Regarding counties doing screening, the OLA report stated, child protection agencies' screening methods are conducive to making objective decisions that are consistent with state law, and that child protection agencies adequately administer intake of child protection of child maltreatment referrals. This bill also seeks to establish consistent reporting requirements regarding screened out cases and data collection in the Social Services Information System, or SSIS, so we can use that to determine a pattern of abuse and screen in the future based on that. The department is currently taking steps with county input to look at data entry issues, but there are things that need to be considered with that. When a report is entered into SSIS and screened out, it does remain in SSIS for up to 2 years and is actually moved on to the federal authorities for reporting. The SSIS system is primarily a case management system. There are many things that can be ascertained from the system, and the department has discussed with the counties the need to look at what and how intakes are entered and kept. Whatever functions are added to this system with regard to data retention need to be value added. And I think that's the point that needs discussion between the department and the counties. There's a workforce and time element that is a reality with counties and is limited by funds. If we do not consider that, we have people entering data that isn't pertinent, and then we spend more time entering data than doing the work that is important and necessary. The OLA did determine that over 50% of the funding for child welfare is county levy dollars, so it would seem appropriate that data entry and the time and value included in that have significant input from the counties. The legislation asks for clarification when it is appropriate for agencies to use the family history of child protection referrals. That's already been defined. It is not appropriate to use past screened out reports as the foundation for screening in future reports. If a report is screened out, it does not meet the statutory guidelines for child protection, and people have a right to privacy as well as a right to not be judged in the future by what did not meet the criteria in the past. The place for using past reports is in a maltreatment determination, since then a full investigation would have been completed and all risk levels assessed. This bill also refers to screened out cases, when in fact, if something is screened out, it does not become a case, but remains a report. And that is an important distinction since each of those terms has definitions used in the child welfare system. The bill also requires the task force to define certain terms. Many of those terms are defined in the screening guidelines, like physical abuse, neglect, and sexual abuse, while others are defined in the assessment process, like risk of harm. Because that is where it's appropriate to make those determinations, counties are concerned that if you define those terms too rigidly, you may actually have fewer cases screened in for assessment. Conversely, if the terms are defined too broadly, you may end up investigating cases that do not require that level of government involvement. Neither of these scenarios is optimal, and some discretion for child protection professionals is appropriate. As noted in the OLA report, child protection intake and screening staff are skilled and trained. Part of that training assists in using professional judgment to determine the appropriate level of intervention. There will always be cases that do not neatly fit within the definitions, but it's appropriate that professionals have the discretion to determine the best course of action in those cases. In conclusion, counties have a positive working relationship with the Child Welfare Division and have already accomplished much of what the OLA report noted as needing clarification through current or proposed statute and regional family assessment meetings that have been focused on updating the screening guidelines and discussing interpretation of those guidelines. Our opinion would be that this proposed law is not necessary at this time and would be time-intensive and work-intensive when most of these proposals have either been accomplished or in process. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hennen, I see that you're from Grant County. I don't think this thing is working at all. I see you're from Grant County. Are you representing Grant County?
I'm representing MACSA. I'm the children's chair, the children's subcommittee for MACSA. I'm the chair of that committee. I'm representing both Grant County and MACSA.
And MACSA is comprised of whom?
Counties.
All counties?
Yes.
So this is all-county association position that you're presenting?
Yes.
Thank you. We have, is there anybody, we can pull you back up, right, if somebody has questions for you later. Christine Borsheim from DHS? Or Kristen? You're not Christian. You're neither. Christian. I'd have to try to figure out how to get this
Madam
right.
Chair, our director, Christine Borsheim, was unable to attend. My name is David Thompson. I'm a child protection manager with the Department of Human Services. We'd just like to add some additional information for the committee to consider as they review this bill. The 2000 report by the Office of Legislative Auditor found that overall the child protection agencies make screening decisions in a reasonable and deliberative fashion. The report, however, did note some gray areas that caused inconsistencies in screening and in the screening practices. During the past year, the department has been involved in a number of efforts to try to respond to those recommendations, including the following. The child welfare training system, which is the training system that all child protection workers go through, has created an online module on screening practices so that that's available at any time and can be accessed as a refresher. This was a recommendation by the auditors. The DHS screening guidelines were updated in September of 2012 and responded to many of the recommendations for clarity concerning anonymous reports, risk of harm, appropriate consideration of past reports, credibility of reporter, and contacting individuals beyond the reporter prior to accepting a report. A bulletin was released in November of 2012 addressing the screening guideline changes and identifying the minimum data retention items required for screened out reports. A statewide screening training was held for county and tribal child protection supervisors in November of 2012. Another is scheduled for April of this year. The OLA concerns and DHS proposed responses were shared with counties and tribes through regional practice meetings, and county and tribal feedback was helped inform the final guidance. Mandated reporter online guidance training that was updated as were instructional brochures for mandated reporters and families. A curriculum for county training of mandated reporters was also updated and is available online. The 2013 legislative policy bill introduced and passed by this committee several weeks ago included addressing the issues of clarifying treatment of anonymous reports. We're recommending that anonymous reports be taken. Clarifying the definition of maltreatment report, and specifying a definitive time for data retention. DHS maintains a constituent service telephone line that's responded to over 1,700 calls in 2012 from families, government, county, and community providers. Senate File 704 also introduces a recommendation for consideration of centralized state screening unit. The cost of centralizing the screening function was examined in 2009 by DHS, and the build-out cost and initial cost for staffing for the first year was estimated at $7 million and $5 million thereafter each year. This included 24/7 capability for responding. The state of Indiana introduced centralized screening beginning in 2010. We had a recent conference with them. They have 80 full-time staff to provide this support function. 3 years later, they still indicate attention from local communities about reports that are screened in and screened out. It's not resolved that issue. Tensions inherent in the child protection system. Some advocates feel that we should do more. Some advocates feel that we're too intrusive into family life. Consistency and expectations that more reports would be accepted for an investigation or family assessment cannot be guaranteed, while the application of local wisdom and control in the decision-making would be lost. It would also provide operational responsibility for child protection, with DHS managing the screening, while all other services and costs are related costs are managed at the local level. We believe that state dollars would be better served providing these funding specifically to families and children who are at risk. Currently, the governor's budget includes an expansion of our Parent Support Outreach Program, which is a program that serves at-risk families who have been screened out from child protection because at that moment they don't meet the statutory definition of maltreatment. It would serve approximately 4,000 families and 10,000 children in the coming year. So we believe that there has been a strong response and that the recommendation under this bill is duplicative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Are there any other persons wishing to testify on this Senate File 704? Seeing none, Senator Hayden, would you like to respond to any of the issues of concern? There seems to be a disagreement about the necessity for this. Since the department has responded to a number of the issues in the auditor's report and from the counties because of concerns about a centralized system, perhaps you'd like to discuss that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I know Mr. Gierman has a kind of a set of issues that he'd like to respond, and then when we start the discussion, I can weigh in even more.
Mr. Gierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there were many issues brought up. Let me just respond to a few of them. We can get the conversation going. In terms of guidelines that have been recently released by the department, I think one of the issues is that I'm not aware that stakeholders or people outside the department and the counties know about that. I don't believe there's a regular way of kind of including stakeholders in those conversations. And I did happen to find some of those, but it's only because I go and check out the website from time to time. One of the questions, for example, that came up was about record retention, and the department's guidelines, updated guidelines, were that all counties have to do in terms of recording information about a report of abuse or neglect is to report that it occurred and the number of children in the family. And that isn't sufficient to be able to identify patterns of abuse and neglect overall, which is just basic best practices. I think in terms of some of the other issues that came up, the cost in other states, Indiana is one example, but we've had communications with others, New Jersey and Florida, for example. Colorado just within the last month or two implemented a statewide hotline. They have much more positive experiences. So I think part of the purpose of this study group is to take a look more comprehensively and not just, cafeteria style pick a one state or another and see what the overall experience has been. I guess one other point I would make, and then we can talk more broadly as you wish, but in terms of services, I think the county representative said there's a variety of services. This is kind of for cases that reach a very high level. I don't believe those services actually exist in any quantity in many counties, certainly not in the metro area. So what we have seen is children being screened out 5, 10, 15, up to 25 times. I've seen one local director shared with me. They come in, 70% of those get referred to this voluntary family assessment program, and 75% of them, at least in Hennepin County, don't even get offered services. So the net-net of all that is when children do get screened in, and we don't have data to know how many times they get screened out first, when they do get screened in, something around 10 or 12% of them actually get any services. And I think that may be statewide. We don't have all the data, but certainly that's in Hennepin. So I think there's a lot of pieces here that I think it would be really good to open this up to a broader stakeholder community, have a thorough conversation about this, address all of the items openly that were brought out in the legislative auditor's report, and then come back to this group with something where everybody who's really involved in this system has a chance to think this through.
Thank you, Mr. Gurman. Sorry. I keep hoping. Can you hear me if I just talk loudly?
Might not get on the tape.
Well, that wouldn't be the worst, I suppose. I think this one is working. Is this working better? Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Seeing no one, if you'll remain at the table, that would be great, because I'm certain there will be some questions at this time from members of the committee. My question is about the bill, Senator Hayden. What you're really talking about here is establishing the mandatory guidance for screening reports. Is that the issue of debate, from your understanding, between the counties and this bill? Is a subdivision 7A under Section 1 shall follow the guidance provided by the Department of Human Services Child Maltreatment Screening Guidelines?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that the essence of the conversation is that we in this bill want to bring in more stakeholders to talk about this issue that the legislative auditor brought forward.
And yes, Senator Hayden, that's under Section 2. And my question, I was going to ask you about that too. That really, as I read it, you know, pretty superficially here, but my grasp of it is it's really a conversation. It's not implementing anything. It's having the conversation and creating a report back to the legislature.
Yes, Madam Chair. That.
And is there a cost associated with that?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if there's a cost associated with that. I don't know if the department, what the department feels about that. I mean, we kind of put together these work groups all the time, and depending on how we structure them, I guess is where the cost would be.
Okay. And of course, we can ask for a fiscal note and determine that. But would the department answer, is there a reason why you'd be opposed to broadening this screening work group if they're not going to be implementing anything but making recommendations?
There's been considerable work already done on this. A number of staff have been involved in this process, so we would estimate at least $100,000 in staff time over the past year. There'll still be a fiscal impact in future staff. The turnaround time is really short. From normal passage would be August 1st, which would give us 3.5 months. It's a very short turnaround time to bring all these individuals together to do the kind of background work that they want and to make recommendations. And there needs to be some clarity around the issue of whether the existing process of county and tribal screening is one of the options that we can consider. The current construction of the legislation does not allow for a continuation of what the current status is. So it seems like a decision has been made already without the research being done about what's in the best practice. So those would be some concerns that we would have.
Okay, thank you. The second portion of what you're talking about, is that an issue that would be discussed further between now and state and local government?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. We don't want the department to oppose the bill. We just really think that we want to broaden this discussion with more stakeholders. So if there are specifics in the bill that that give the department some indigestion other than them just not liking to put the group together because they already felt like they've done the work, and that's what I've been hearing, we'd be more than happy to sit down and talk with them.
Yeah, and I find a little bit of a conflict between if a lot of work has been done and this committee reviews it. It seems as though there's a lot of work that could be integrated into the report from work that's already done. And the deadline for this is not August 1st. I think it's pushed off to November 15, 2013.
No, the start date would be August 1st, and then 3.5 months from then would be the report date. There's a lot of people to bring up to date on this matter. Most of these individuals have not been part of this discussion. It's been in the county and tribal and state conversation. So there would be time, and we'd have to be respectful of the ability of those individuals to meet. It is a very short turnaround time for most reports that we have. We mostly usually have a year for these kinds of reports.
And I hear, Senator Hayden, you might look at that date then. If we get past the hurdle of whether or not it's necessary, I think the question here is about the date of the report. Perhaps that's something that you can look at with the department. Senator Rosen?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just looking at when this OLA report came out, which was February of 2012. So the department obviously has been very well aware of the issues pertaining in this going forward with child protection. And frankly, and I'm just going to be a little brutal, Senator Lori knows this, you, Madam Chair, know this, I know this. Back in the good old days, this was just something that the department had to do without a fiscal note. We just expect them to do this. We're talking about child protection, by golly. So this is a serious thing that I think, frankly, the department should get going, and there shouldn't be a fiscal cost to it.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Senator Hayden, I just would also recommend, based on DHS's concern about time frame, that you could make the implementation date at the point of the governor's signature, and that might pick up a couple extra months for you to begin the process instead of waiting till August 1st. So maybe we can have something that improves on both ends, in terms of timing, should this committee determine that it's worth the initiative. Is there anybody else that would like to ask a question from the committee? Would you like that change to the effective date right at this time? We can make the change in the bill before we
take action.
Madam Chair,
yeah, I think that would be appropriate, if that's the appropriate time.
Okay. Ms. White, would you offer the amendment language that Senator Hayden is introducing?
Madam Chair and members, on page 4, after line 30, insert, this bill is effective the day following final enactment, period.
Everyone clear on the amendment? Senator Eden offers the verbal amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes? You can consider the other date. It's being referred, if it moves from here, it'll be referred to state and local government, so you can look at that again there. Is there any further discussion, Senator Eden? All right. On Senate File 704 is amended to be referred to state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes and is referred to state and local government.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Eaton on Senate File 245. Are there any amendments to this one?
Oh, there's a little whining.
Do you have any amendments to the bill, Senator Eaton?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Senator Eaton moves Senate File 245. Be passed and referred to finance. On the bill, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would essentially eliminate the child cap, family cap that's in law right now in the MFIP bill. And Minnesota is only one of 18 states that has this law, this family cap in law. And it is not working like it was supposed to. I will let our...
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Senator Eaton. Would you introduce yourself to the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And many of you are familiar with the family cap within the Minnesota Family Investment Program, but what this does is when a mom is on assistance and has another child, that child is denied any other assistance. So our whole program is based on family size, but under this law, if you have another baby, that baby is denied assistance. And to give you a little more context about where this law came from, in the late 80s, early 90s, when welfare reform was raging at the federal level, there was a very strong stereotype that emerged about who was receiving assistance. That stereotype was of an African-American woman who drives a Cadillac and has a lot of babies to get a bigger welfare check. And that stereotype was picked up by states across the country, including Minnesota. Minnesota was not immune to riding the wave on that stereotype. And these laws, these family cap laws, were passed in states across the country. And what we have now is 15 years plus of experience showing that these laws were not effective. All they did was deny assistance to low-income children who were born to low-income moms. In Minnesota specifically, we have 10 years of data that show that low-income babies didn't stop being born. All we did was deny assistance to low-income children. So this law has been repealed in three other states, Maryland, New Jersey, Illinois. Other states are looking at repealing this law. It was never effective. It's bad policy, and it's we've been up here probably every year since it passed talking about what bad policy it is, but now we're standing on facts. We're standing on data. 10 years of data that says this hasn't worked, and it's not even budget savings anymore because there is TANF money within the TANF reserve and with unspent TANF dollars to repeal this law and to provide the assistance to the babies that it was intended for. So thank you for your time. This year we do have a broad coalition of support. I think you'll hear from pro-life voices, pro-choice voices, the faith community, the anti-poverty community, and we just hope that this is time to repeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I just wanted to state, I forgot to, one of the things that concerns me in particular, all of this does, but we have over 1,000 of these capped children live in families with significant physical and mental illness and severe disabilities. These are, they're losing $125 a month for this child and with increased issues going on in the family. And 70% are children of color. So that disproportionately hurts Native Americans and African American children. So,
thank you, Senator Eaton. We have other testifiers on the list, and I assume that you're finished, Senator Eaton, and I should call them forward.
Yes, please.
All right, Scott Fishbach, Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life. That's a familiar name around here.
Madam Chairman, I am Scott Fishbach, and I serve as the Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life. As the Executive Director for MCCL for 12 years, I've actually never testified in the state of Minnesota. This is my very first time, and this is the very first bill, because this bill cuts to the core of the pro-life movement and who we are and why we work so hard to protect those innocent lives here in Minnesota. So on behalf of the 70,000 members from Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, we want to offer our support to Senator Eaton for the repeal of the family cap on Senate File 245. The family cap legislation was actually implemented in 2003 over our objections. Our disapproval of this law has only intensified as we've learned more, and the State Department of Health, as well as Human Services, has given us more and more information about what is happening under this policy. We also know that this is also a group of individuals in Minnesota that are offered free abortions because of our taxpayer-funded abortion policy, yet these families are not offered the support that they need to go ahead and carry their child to term and the support that they need for those first incredibly important 1,000 days of the child's life. The reason why women have abortions in our state has remained constant for many years. The annual abortion report shows that women feel they cannot have a baby due to the lack of financial, educational, or emotional support. Various academic institutions, including a widely cited study from Rutgers University, have concluded that not only do family caps not decrease birth rates for poor families, family caps actually increase abortion rates, which are evidenced by our own numbers here in Minnesota. During the time period of 2001 and 2010, the overall number of abortions have dropped 22% in our state. The percentage of taxpayer-funded abortions being performed in our state has risen from 21% in 2001, prior to the family cap, up to 34% in 2010, after the family cap. Nearly a third of all of the abortions done in our state now are taxpayer-funded. This is something that we believe can be reversed with the reversal of the family cap. So on behalf of our membership, we urge the Minnesota Legislature to readdress this failed policy of the family cap and repeal the family cap this year, this legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Fishbach. Please hang in here if there are any questions. We're going to complete the testimony first. Alex Fitzsimmons from the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director of the Children's Defense Fund.
Thank you,
Welcome,
Chair.
Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. At CDF, we primarily advocate for policies that do two things. One, that improve the well-being of children, and number two, that strengthen the economic security of families. And we believe that repealing the family cap does both. Generally, as you know, the MFIP grant amount is based on family size. However, as you have heard today, no adjustment is made for the additional cost of a newborn if the family was receiving MFIP assistance at the time of the baby's conception. This lack of funds further financially strains the approximately one out of every seven families receiving MFIP assistance with a newborn. The current MFIP grant leaves a family of three at 62% of the federal poverty guidelines. If an additional child is born, their income is reduced to 51% of poverty as a result of the family cap. This is deep poverty and is highly correlated with poor childhood and adulthood outcomes. We believe that repealing the family cap is important for two reasons. First, as I just shared, the family cap pushes families deeper into poverty and at a time when families are under a great deal of stress, not just the stress associated with poverty and its associated experiences, but also the stresses associated with having a new baby. Last week, my colleague Marcy Jeffries and I spoke with you about maternal depression and its impact on early childhood. 44% of caregivers in MFIP families had a diagnosed mental health disorder in the last 3 years. The most frequent diagnosis? Depression. One longer-term solution for reducing the incidence of depression includes addressing the broader context in which depression occurs. The significant role that the emotional and financial strains of poverty impose should be considered when evaluating the family cap. And second, the deep poverty that results from not recognizing a newborn child is especially harmful to the child and his or her siblings, especially when they are young. It is not solely poverty or the degree of poverty that matters for child outcomes, but when during childhood that poverty occurs. Poverty early in a child's life is especially harmful for outcomes related to achievement skills and cognitive development. This committee knows full well the critical importance of early childhood and brain development and for establishing the neural functions and structures that shape future cognitive, social, emotional, and health outcomes. From the little data we have on the 70,000 children receiving MFIP each month, including the 35,000 children who are under the age of six, we know they are not doing well. In fact, 61% of children ages 3 months to 5 years screened as part of a pilot project scored positive for possible cognitive, emotional, or behavioral delays. Increasing the incomes of families living in deep poverty by repealing the family cap can have a positive impact on child development. Repealing the family cap and thereby recognizing the additional costs associated with raising an additional child could result in approximately $75 per month or $900 per year for a child and his or her family. This amount is not insignificant. Findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average annual family income throughout early childhood can result in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. And as far as outcomes during adulthood, according to a 2011 research study for families with early childhood income below $25,000, a $3,000 annual boost to family income is associated with a 17% increase in adult earnings. Repealing the family cap could have a positive developmental impact on thousands of Minnesota children, and as a result, it can also have a positive and long-lasting impact on our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. May I ask you a question before you leave? You have described the data that demonstrates what poverty's impact is on childhood development, and also a relationship between poverty and the existence of maternal child depression. And I think it's been inferred, but I want to go back to, I think, the data that's demonstrating that the cap has not had an impact on births after a family gets on MFIP. Is that correct? Did I hear that along the way, that the data does not indicate a significant change in birth rates as a result of being restricted from resources in MFIP? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's my understanding. And I can also point to a study that was done in 2012. There were 23 states at the time that had family caps, and Ms. Webster can help me with this piece. But I believe at the time of the states that looked at, I believe there were four states that looked at whether or not the family cap in their states had an impact, and it didn't have an impact as far as birth rates go. And that's our same understanding. That's our same understanding here.
And am I correct in understanding that that was the underlying kind of explanation for why a cap would make sense, that if we had families assessed for MFIP payments but limited it to the size of the family at that time, that it would stop what people thought was happening, that people were having children in order to get more public money, that was conceptually what the cap was trying to resolve, and the data indicates that there hasn't been a significant change in birth rates. Am I understanding the data correctly?
Yes, Madam Chair, okay. That the purpose of the family cap was to deter women from having more babies once they were receiving assistance.
Yes. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question at this time? I don't have to be the only one. Jason Adkins is also here to testify. Jason is the Executive Director and General Counsel of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. Welcome, Mr. Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Jason Adkins, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I've submitted written testimony on the family cap, and that has a lot of the same arguments and statistics that were used by Mr. Fishbach and Ms. Fitzsimmons. Out of consideration for the committee's time, I just point to three things. First of all, as has been mentioned, the statistical evidence casts doubt on the original policy rationale of the family cap in the first place. Birth rates haven't declined after the family cap was enacted in 2002. I note also that we shouldn't be punishing children who are directly affected by the family cap because they lack the moral agency and are not responsible for the actions of the adults in their lives. Third, I note the incidence of a doubling in the rate of abortions procured for economic reasons since 2003. In 2002, the rate of abortions in Minnesota performed for economic reasons was 17%, and in 2011, that statistic was 34%. So for the reasons outlined in my written testimony submitted to this committee and some of the reasons you've heard here this afternoon, we would support Senator Eaton's bill and a repeal of the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you. May I ask you a question as well? I'm not sure I've got my question formulated very well, or I would have asked Mr. Fishbach as well. One of the things that I think we can all come around, regardless of the position on abortion, is that reducing the number of abortions is a common goal. And if we can understand what's driving it and create the support systems that are necessary to alleviate the rationale, that's a good thing. We share that. All of us share that. And poverty is one of them, or economics, is what you're saying to me. But where I get confused is why, if we aren't seeing a change in the number, in the birth rate with the cap, we're not seeing a change in the birth rate, but we are seeing a reduction in the abortions or how, we're seeing an increase in the abortions related with it, with an economic explanation for the rationale in abortions. So if that wasn't there, we may see an increase in the birth rate with even though there's a cap in place, an even greater increase or an increase. Right now it's neutral. Is that right, Senator Eaton? It's not a significant change, but...
My understanding is that it's been stable, the numbers and percentages.
So if people were not taking the option of abortion, we would see an increase. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correct? Of abortions I'm talking about.
Well, we would see a decrease. Senator Sharon, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the rate of abortion has decreased since 2002 in Minnesota. However, the rate of abortions procured for economic reasons has increased. Now, it seems to me that if family cap were repealed, there is a possibility that the rate of abortions procured for economic reasons and perhaps even the rate of abortion overall would, in fact, decrease.
Okay. And further decrease.
And that is something, as you said, whatever side of the abortion issue you are on, abortions procured for economic reasons is, in fact, a tragedy, and I think we can all acknowledge that. So this would represent a very positive step forward that people on both sides of the abortion debate could get behind.
Oh, thank you. That clarifies what I was trying to put my head around. Thank you very much. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Eaton, you mentioned the other states that have worked on this, that have repealed it. Have they repealed this and have seen a change in the data, or how long do you expect it to take to see a reverse in this where you see less abortions in this economic...
That was not my testimony. I'll have to...
Jessica. Please give us your name and identify who you represent.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and we don't have data yet on the Maryland, Illinois, New Jersey abortion data or birth data. But I think one thing that's kind of important to recognize is nobody that's testified today is saying that there's direct causation between the family cap and abortion. It's one thing that has passed in the last, since 2003. It's one indicator. It's one thing that's caused more stress on families in terms of finances. So I think we need to be careful about saying the family cap does or doesn't cause everyone's abortions, and I don't think we could ever show the research that would show that. Does that make sense?
Yes, I understand, but I do think that we have a shared interest in identifying what the drivers are, what
Absolutely.
The person reports, and if poverty is
Absolutely.
One of them, then we share. It's one place where we have a common ground that is being represented here today, that we need to do the things we can to attack the drivers, the root cause of what might be contributing to abortion rates, which we all would like to see go down. I'm not saying that there's a causal effect, but we do know there's a relationship between what people say about poverty. Okay, good. Very good. Any further discussion or questions on this bill? I appreciate everyone's presence here today. Thank you very much. Senator Eaton renews her motion that Senate File 245 pass and be referred to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say nay. Passes. Referred to Finance. Okay, Senator Eaton, Senate File 165.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, the MFIP, that most people are aware of. It used to be AFDC, Aid for Families with Children or whatever. And what we're talking about is that I think it's 28% are of the funding that we get from TANF, which is the federal funds, is going in actual cash payments to these families. And they have not had an increase since... Well, it's been a number of years.
1983?
Yep, there you go. So in today's dollars, they've actually had a severe decrease in funds. I know that some people feel that it's a I can't. No, I. Go ahead. You have it. I know that people have said that we shouldn't continue to support families who don't work and have children to receive more assistance, but this is already a work program. It's already a requirement that people are working, and they have to meet work requirements to stay in the program. So,
okay, Senator Eaton, thank you. We have a number of persons that would like to testify to this bill. Several, so I'm hoping that we will be able to keep our testimony focused.
I'm sorry, I didn't know who was first.
What I have is Alex Fitzsimmons first, but and then followed by Chris Jacobs and Ebony Harris, so that you know the order. Hello, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Welcome back to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It hasn't been long. So, as you know, I'm from Children's Defense Fund, and I don't want to duplicate the testimony that I just gave, but most of the testimony that I did just share applies also to increasing the grants for families receiving MFIP assistance. As Senator Eaton was referencing, the grants have not been increased in a number of years, actually since 1986. And so, in addition to the testimony that I shared on what we know about child development, especially early childhood development, and what we know about children who are receiving MFIP assistance, I'll just reiterate that 7 out of 10 MFIP recipients are children, half are under the age of 6, and what we know again about their development is that they're not doing well. But I also want to share, too, that that's not the end of the story, because there are interventions that can be done. There's early intervention. There are other pieces. But right now, we're focusing on this income piece. So there are three pieces that I would like to additionally share with you. One is that we know, let me first just share that with the grant, how the MFIP grant works, that there is a cash grant, there's a cash portion of the grant, and there's a food portion of the grant. So, for example, a family of three, the full grant amount is $1,005. $532 is for cash, $473 is for food. And what we know is with that cash, so again, family size of three, $532 of cash, that two-thirds of families receiving MFIP assistance have to pay for their housing costs with that grant, in addition to their other expenses that they must also pay for with their cash. And I have from the Minnesota Housing Partnership just some fair market rents to share with you. I'll just share a couple. But fair market rent for a modest two-bedroom apartment in Pine County is $602 a month. It's much higher in Washington County, where a fair market rent value for a two-bedroom apartment is $904. So just keeping that in perspective when we're looking at that $532 cash grant amount. Secondly, and this is just more so by a point of reference, that the USDA does a cost of raising a child calculator. You can go to their website. You can plug in lots of different information about the number of children in your family, what region you are in the United States. And then they have three different income levels. They have under $59,000, over $59,000, and then they've added an increased one. But I plugged in a few different pieces, and I added, so family size, actually a four, with two children, ages 2 and 6, living in the Midwest, income less than $59,000, that was the lowest that we could go, and that it cost $17,570 per year to raise two children. So again, just trying to keep these different pieces in mind. And then lastly, just as I shared earlier, again, in focusing on this early childhood piece, that there's so much discussion about early childhood and the investments that we can make in the early years. There are the discussions about the early childhood scholarships, child care, and these investments. And I really encourage this committee to think about this policy and looking at increasing the grants within that same early childhood continuum, and to really think about it as an investment in children and as an investment in school readiness. So thank you, and I really encourage you to support raising the grant. Thank you.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, could you articulate for us what the eligibility, who is it that is an MFIP recipient? Describe that in the criteria that they have to meet and the activity they have to engage in order to be eligible for this money.
Madam Chair, I am probably not the best person to do that, but I would suggest that the members that brought forth this bill would probably be the best to do that from the Welfare Rights Committee. So if I may,
yes.
I can answer the question, but I don't think that I'm the best person to do so.
Well, thank you. We'll find out before we get through here, I'm sure. Is this Chris Jacobs? Hello, Chris Jacobs, Executive Director of Jobs Now Coalition. Can you answer my question?
Good afternoon. yes.
Okay, great, thank you.
No, I can't answer your question.
Oh, okay. We'll get somebody here to answer it. And Ebony Harris, would you like to please approach? And then that's followed by Lena Bugs. Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Jacobs.
Madam Chairwoman and the rest of the committee, thank you very much for hearing my testimony today. While the welfare grant for Minnesota families of two is the same as it was 26, 27, 28, 29, 30 years ago, the average cost of meeting basic needs for a family has risen dramatically. We can measure part of this increase by looking at JobsNow's first cost of living in Minnesota report, which computed the cost of basic needs for 1994. Here's what we find. Over this 15-year period, the combined statewide average cost of food and housing jumped from $742 a month to $1,119 a month, an increase of 51%. Here's another way to think about it. During the 15 years JobsNow conducted its cost of living research, the combined monthly cost of food and housing for a family of two went up $377, which is only $60 less than the entire monthly welfare grant received by this family. For most welfare recipients, finding a job remains a challenge. Although the state's job vacancy survey shows that Minnesota's job market is improving, we still have almost 100,000 more job seekers than job openings. If finding a job is difficult, finding a good one is even harder. Of the 59,000 job openings in Minnesota, only about 36,000 are full-time. Statewide, job seekers still outnumber full-time job openings by 4-1. For the 23,000 part-time job openings in Minnesota, the median wage is $9.41 an hour. I have the most recent job vacancy numbers here available for the committee. I can tell you when you look at these numbers, you'll see that job creation and job growth is in low-wage sectors, which is a very, very large sector. I'm asking the committee, please don't punish low-income parents and their families. Please pass this bill. And thank you, Senator Eaton, very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. Ms. Harris, and then Lena Bugs, if you'd come forward at this time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Senator Sharon, for allowing me to testify. Thank you to the committee. As you know, my name is Ebony Harris, and I am a former welfare recipient, and I can definitely say that we need to raise the grants. It's very much the right thing to do. In this economy, it is very impossible to find a job, even a low-wage, minimum-wage job. I should know because I have one and I only work 1 to 2 days a week. And those are the jobs that are out there that's what's given that's out there. By raising the grants, this would help our economy and it would help recipients to get off of welfare faster due to the fact that market rate rent, they would be able to afford even an efficiency. I can definitely say from experience, when I was getting $437 at the time, my rent was $328, which left me with $111, $12 to pay lights, phone, diapers, etc. I went without a phone for about almost four years till I got housing assistance, and that takes years, sometimes decades. As of now, in the metro area, the affordable or for Section 8 waiting list has been closed since 2007 or 2008, and there's no hope of them opening up. And with what's going on in D.C., who knows what's going to happen with that federal program. I can definitely say I remember when they rose the grants in Minnesota. I was 15 at North High School, and when I was living on it, it was very hard. It was very hard. I know all about being stereotyped since I'm an African-American woman. And it's really, 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 I can't even go into it, but I know it's really demeaning when you're trying to find a job, work, become stable, and it doesn't help when you have rhetoric coming from all sides of the spectrum and accusing you of being lazy and, you know, and just the usual stereotypes that some politicians like to throw during election time. The cost of living, though, in Minnesota definitely, I can say, has tripled. I'm not even going to say doubled, tripled. And even with raising the grants, it would still keep it's still under the poverty level, but it would be much better by raising the grants than to what it is now. I can't even imagine anybody getting an apartment on if that's their only sole income. Like I said, there's nowhere you can get affordable place to live. That would make shelters go turn around. It would be a low rate in shelter use if the grants were raised, because then that way people can move on to self-sufficiency to find a place. I can definitely say, just doing this campaign for this and talking to different people, I've been getting all kinds of, responses. And one thing that really disturbs me is how when I try to talk to some lawmakers and said, why don't you take the challenge, they've said no because they can't live on 437. And my question is, if you can't live on 437 a month, how do you expect thousands of Minnesotans to do it? Because I'm going to tell you, you can't. You just can't do it. You can't even buy a gallon of milk, barely, and then there's your money. This will also help families to become self-sufficient where they can go on to get a job and move on with their lives and move into the middle class. But right now, at these rates with the welfare guidelines, it keeps families stuck and trapped. And like I said, I'm 42 years old. The last time I saw the grants was raised was when I was 15 in 1986. So I'm just asking the committee to please keep an open mind and raise the grants. This is detrimental to the children of our state, since most of the children are on some type of assistance. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Harris. Ms. Bugs, and then would Bruni Hesse please approach the table?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and committee members here. Thank you for allowing me this testimony. It is imperative that the welfare grants be raised in the state of Minnesota. As testimony has previously supported, the grants have not been raised since 1986. And basically what that's doing is that sentencing poor women and children to poverty.
Could you affirm your identity for me? Your name?
Yes, my name is Lena Bugs.
Thank you.
And I'm here with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm also here as a small business owner representing the private sector who employs a staff of six, primarily made up of former welfare recipients. I myself was living on welfare in 1990. And I was able to, at that time, MFIP was actually a good program that was used as a stepping stone so that persons like myself, well, welfare recipients, could work their way off of MFIP. If you ask the average MFIP recipient, would you rather have a decent livable wage job or would you choose welfare, I'm pretty willing and betting that they will say that they're wanting to have a livable wage job. So I think I'm here to also dispel rumors. Welfare recipients are also displaced workers because there's a circumstance before you go on welfare that happens to you, why you're needing this this bottom floor ground wage level. So, in having said that, and being an employer of six welfare recipients that I actively chose out, I just want to say that doubling the grants is the right thing to do. Right now, if you double the grants, people are still living 70% below the poverty level right now. So doubling the grants would actually put them at 30% below the poverty level right now. And I can tell you, when I went to college and I was living with two or three families while I was on MFIP, trying to work my way off of MFIP, it was extremely difficult. Now, this was in approximately 1990. Having since worked myself off of MFIP, I now own two small businesses, and I do employ in one business six people and in the other business three people. And I can tell you right now that the cost, the transportation cost for these welfare recipients, it's also important to note, too, that I do pay a decent livable wage. These are part-time positions that I'm offering, part-time administrative positions. Their salary is $15 per hour, which currently is higher than most part-time positions here in the state of Minnesota, who part-time employers are paying anywhere between $7.25 an hour and $9 per hour. So I think that's important. important to note as well that you're actually listening to a former welfare recipient and business owner who is paying well above the minimum wage for part-time positions. In addition to that, I'm sorry, did you have a question, Madam Chair?
No, I was going to thank you for your testimony. I didn't mean to interrupt. I thought you were finished. I'm sorry.
And I will keep this brief, and then I will be done momentarily. Going on, I do wish to say that it is right to double the welfare grants. And not only that, but welfare recipients are living right now, hand to mouth right now. You can't afford a decent, medium, fair market apartment right now, let alone the dream of buying a home. So you can't afford that on $437 a month, which is the grant for one child, and it's the grant for one parent. It's $532 for two children and one parent right now. And I think that I would like the committee to take into consideration here that we're talking about the lives and the futures here of children. And, you know, I find it deplorable that last legislative session that the – I will wrap it up – last legislative session that the Vikings were granted $975 million to build a stadium. But I stand before you, I sit before you here in the committee asking to double the welfare grants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bernie Hesse, and then that will be followed by Sue Watlaw Phillips. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. We represent workers in long-term care, retail, grocery, food processing, and some manufacturing. We stand here today to ask you to support the increase in the grant. You've heard a lot of things today doing this, but the thing that is really driven home for us of late is we've had a number of plant closings and folks that are laid off. These are older workers, and often unemployment is about the only thing that they're seeing. We've had a number of folks that have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks, a number of folks that have been unemployed for over a year that have not been able to find work. And I'll give you one fact. There's more than 55,000 Minnesotans right now who are in long-term unemployment. That's more than 26 weeks. I think we need to find the resources so folks will have the safety net when unemployment insurance runs out. A lot of people forget that unemployment insurance was put in place to help folks find work, get back to work quickly. When that runs out, often there aren't a lot of safety nets for workers to hang on. So we support this bill. We want to thank the senator for moving this forward, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Before you begin your testimony, I would summarize for those, this is for me mostly, to articulate out loud, that MFIP recipients must be residents of Minnesota and U.S. citizens in order to apply for the program. Furthermore, there must be a minor child in the home. MFIP already ensures that the funds are spent that are spent are going towards the struggling family and their children. The cash portion of MFIP assistance helps pay for basic necessities, and there are expenses that are not covered by the food portion. And what is not talked about here is the requirements related to seeking employment. So that's also a component of MFIP, is the need to demonstrate movement towards employment, finding full employment. Thank you. All right. Would you introduce yourself, Ms. Phillips, and your background, and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I am the president and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I'm also a board member of MICA, the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, as well as an honorary board member of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I do have copies of my testimony as well as an additional handout, if that could be handed out, please.
We have a page.
I also have worked 42 years with people at risk or experiencing homelessness, and so I am in support of Senate File 165 and have been working hard. These two, please, right now. to see an increase in these grants for a long time. The housing costs on the MFIP grant does not provide enough money for housing. What you'll see on the yellow piece of paper that's coming out is utilizing data from HUD that the National Low Income Housing Coalition has put together, what it would cost for people to afford housing in Minnesota. You need to be making a wage of $15.50 an hour, working full-time, 52 weeks, 40 hours a week. And the average two-bedroom apartment costs $806. Now, that varies by each county. I do have for the committee by county what the cost is for housing, as well as a similar graph of the housing costs across the country, too, so that you will see that we are about in the mid-range of what housing costs are in the country. The lack of a livable income is the primary reason that people become homeless. While our Minnesota Representative Housing Committee currently today are touring shelters and homeless programs, you have one of the most effective measures for preventing the majority of family homelessness by passing this bill, increasing MFIP grants, as well as continuing the emergency assistance program under the TANF program. That's the block grant that comes from the federal government. So again, this will prevent family homelessness, save significant amounts of dollars. MICA, which is a Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, believes that everyone, without exception, has the right to a safe, decent, affordable, and accessible place to call home. As people of faith, we believe that how you treat the least of these is how we treat our God. We are commanded in our faith to love others as we love ourselves. That means we need to treat other people the way we would want to be treated if we were in the same situation. So I encourage you to take the challenge. Try to live on 437 or 532. It's impossible to do that. Research shows that poverty is the greatest predictor of poor school performance, poor health, and homelessness. Both Wilder Research and University of Minnesota have multiple studies. If you'd like to see them, I'd be happy to give them to you. We can save incredible resources in emergency responses and other services, both in this committee as well as in our housing committee, by investing resources more wisely and allow people themselves to meet their own basic needs. Instead of having to run to a variety of programs besides MFIP, other housing programs, they should be able to pay for that themselves with the MFIP grant. Finally, as a conservative woman, my choice is pro-life. Pro-life means conception to death, not conception to birth. The children on MFIP are God's creation. They are our potential future legislators, business leaders, and employees. Let's invest in their lives at a level that allows them to become productive adults and to become all that God has created them to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hess. Ms. Phillips.
That's fine.
Thank you. Sorry. Next we have Angel Buencher. Is that close?
Buechner.
Okay. Ms. Buechner, and followed by, Ms. Kanishi.
Deb Kanishny couldn't be here, and the plan was to share the testimony with Angel and myself. I'm Lyndon Galboy, so we'll be sharing the Welfare Rights Committee testimony.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Would you please introduce yourselves to the committee?
Senator Sharon, members of the committee, my name is Angel Buechner. This is my grandson, Mercury Morgan Buechner. He's 2 months old today. And this is his mother. And I'm doing this testimony on behalf of 165 for this family. So I would just like to thank you for the opportunity of doing this. And thank you for the opportunity of signing on to it. Welfare Rights Committee are members of current and former welfare recipients. We are here to speak in support of Senate File 165. Today, 70,000 Minnesotan children are receiving public assistance through Minnesota's Family Investment Program.
7 out of 10 of those who receive MFEP cash grants are children. Right now, these 70,000 Minnesotan children are living in what is considered extreme poverty. One bill, Senate File 165, would change all of that. Here are the number of facts. The cash grants for children and their caregivers on MFEP have not been increased since 1986, 27 years ago. Meanwhile, the cost of living has more than doubled since 1986. In 1986, a family of two, a parent and a child, received $437 per month in cash to live on. Today, in 2013, an MFEP family of two still receives $437. This adds up to $5,244 a year. If calculated per day, this means two people receive $14.57 a day. Remember, this is the total amount of money to pay for rent, utility bills, phone, children's school costs, transportation costs, clothes, hygiene, household supplies, laundry costs, additional food costs when food stamps run out, and for gas, insurance, and car repairs, if lucky enough to have those. Everything for the entire family. The result is homelessness and hunger. As you know, it is impossible to find housing for $437 a month. In fact, it is at least $200 less than what a typical one-bedroom apartment rents for at the market rate. It's no wonder that the average age of homelessness individual in Minnesota is age 7. Just to put this in further perspective, the amount an MFEP family of two receives to live on per day is about what another individual might spend for 3 large coffee lattes in a day.
And my name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm going to continue. The current MFIP cash grants, the cash portion, puts the family at least 70% below the federal poverty level, what is considered extreme poverty. Even the Minnesota DHS, in their overview to the legislature, stated that extreme poverty has the most adverse effect on children's health and well-being. Even if the MFIP grants were doubled, families would still be 30% below the federal poverty level. The money is there. If the entire federal TANF block grant were used for cash grants for poor Minnesota families as intended, the MFIP grants could nearly be doubled. It's time to start talking about paying back not just the school funding shift, but the TANF funding shift. According to figures from the Department of Human Services in 2012, only 27% of the yearly federal TANF block grant funds went to poor families in Minnesota. And you should have a handout in your packet about that. Over the past decade, billions of dollars from Minnesota's TANF block grant have been taken to supplant general fund spending on other programs. Meanwhile, MFIP families have been living in desperate conditions, becoming homeless, living doubled up, tripled up with others, and forced to make terrible choices. So while these families have been struggling with desperate situations, keep in mind that only 27% of the federal dollars that the state gets that are intended for welfare went to their welfare, while 73% were rated to fund other things. In addition to no increase, the grants have been cut year after year after year. The cash grants have been reduced with sanctions, penalties for living in subsidized housing, if you can even get in, the family cap, and the 5-year limit. The amount of state dollars that went to cash assistance to poor families is less than 0.25% of the general fund. Of the whole state budget, it's 0.1%. But when you hear certain politicians talk, you'd think that it was like everything. It's nothing. In these tough economic times, welfare is a working person's issue. When unemployment insurance runs out, people are shocked. Parents are shocked to find out that they still don't qualify for MFIP because they're not poor enough. In many cases, a lot of folks who are on MFIP and who get jobs will never qualify for unemployment because of the part-time, because of the temporary. MFIP is the unemployment insurance for the poorest of the poor who work seasonal and temporary jobs. When women and children are attempting to escape from an abusive situation, a situation of domestic violence, many times the only means of support is MFIP. Without MFIP, women and children are forced to stay with their abusers. So to wrap up, raising the cash assistance grants is the right thing to do, and it makes sense. Senate File 165 will bring 70,000 of Minnesota's children out of extreme poverty overnight. This means that the Minnesota's children's health and well-being, education and potential will dramatically improve overnight. It's good for the economy. Families will buy needed items, putting money directly back into local economies. Hunger, homelessness, health crises, domestic violence, and poverty cost much more than increasing the MFIP cash grants. As far as subsidized housing, increasing the grants will free up more subsidized housing because there'll be more money that goes into the rent, and so the subsidies won't have to be as great. Finally, it'll help folks, as has already been spoken to, get to work much faster instead of being put so deep in the hole that it's impossible to get out of. It's impossible to look for work and apply for jobs if we can't keep our phones on, if we're moving from one place to another, homeless shelters, no consistent address, there's no money for transportation, or when we're living in a shelter. This is a copy of our testimony. Also in your packets, you'll see some resolutions passed by a couple of large labor unions in support of this, and also a list of organizations so far that have signed on to this effort. So thank you, Senator Charan, for having a hearing on this bill. We ask that you please support Senate File 165.
Thank you. I would like to ask a couple of questions now. Was it Ms. Galboy?
Galboy.
Would you spell that for me?
G-A-W-B-O-Y.
I understand, or Senator Eaton, the bill doesn't change the family wage, the eligibility based on family wage. It simply changes what the cash portion would be in relationship to that wage, correct?
Correct.
So it doesn't do anything to resolve the issue that Ms. Galboy talked about, where people are surprised about the level of poverty you have to be at in order to be accessible, have this accessible. You're not addressing that in this bill.
Not to my knowledge.
And I just want to be clear about that. So it's all the structure is the same. The only thing that's changing is that you're increasing the cash assistance program. Correct. And could you are you able to articulate, Ms. Galboy, what the employment requirements are, what the expectations are of the MFIP parents in relationship to employment?
You mean currently?
Currently, yes.
Yeah. Currently, and I just want to kind of go back to this because a lot of people hear welfare and they just think whatever, that MFIP, it mainly goes to children. You know, 7 out of 10 people who get MFIP are children. The rest are their parents. So this is a welfare program for children with unemployed parents whose unemployment insurance has run out, or if there's a disability in the family and the parent can't work. In order to get assistance, parents have to spend hours every week filling out paperwork and looking for a job and proving that they've looked for a job. I heard the commissioner, Belinda Jensen, on NPR last week saying it's almost to the point of ridiculousness of some of the hoops that people have to jump through while you're on MFIP to kind of for paperwork purposes as opposed to getting into a meaningful living wage job. So meanwhile, while people are living in this extreme poverty, folks have to, you know, kind of do this make work stuff that's not working.
And Ms. Galboy, the requirements as it relates to pursuing a job comes out of a concern. This is a question. I'm making it as a declarative statement, but it's really a question. Concern that we do not want to develop programs that encourage passivity in terms of government dependence. That if within MFIP, if there are requirements about getting people back to work, that we will not have enabled people to stay on government programs. Is that underlying attitude a part of what the employment expectations are for the parents in these families?
Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton.
This is true. Right now, the 1996 law sets forth 12 categories for work activities that can count toward the work rates. 9 of them are core categories that count toward any participation. They are subsidized private sector employment, subsidized public sector employment, work experience, on-the-job training, job search, and job readiness assistance, community service programs, vocational educational training for up to 12 months, and providing child care services to an individual who is participating in community service program. The 3 non-core activities are job skills training directly related to employment, education directly related to employment, and satisfactory attendance at secondary school or in a course of study leading to a GED.
Ms. White, did you want to say something further on this? It says here that you have information on work requirements.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Madam Chair, members, I was just going to indicate the number of hours they participants need to be in a work activity, as Senator Eaton indicated. And for families with no child under 6 years old, it's 130 hours per month, which is about 32 and a half hours per week. Mm-hmm. If the participant has a child under 6, it's 87 hours per month, which is about 22 hours per week. And in a two-parent family, it's 55 hours per week combined.
Okay, thank you. And can you tell me, some persons on this receiving cash assistance and food, the food portion of MFIP, have vouchers, housing vouchers, and others do not. Does the presence of those other resources impact this program? Senator Eaton or anyone who would like to answer that question?
Yes, I mean, it's all based on what your current assets and income are. So if you're not having an expenses. So if you're not having to spend $500 on rent, it would decrease your payment that you receive from MFIP.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from members of the committee? Senator Nelson and Senator Hoffman. We'll start with Senator Nelson, then move to Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've not seen a fiscal note on this. Do we know how much that your bill would cost and where the money would come from? It looks to me like it would create a hole in the general fund. Is that where you're just kind of, if you could explain kind of the financing of this bill for me, even though this isn't the finance committee, I think it's important to know.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The TANF grant, which is program, which is the federal funding, comes to the state of Minnesota, and we must do a maintenance of effort, which is a certain matching of funds. Out of that pot, right now we are currently giving about 27% to 28% of it in cash grants. The rest of it is going, I assume, into the general fund to pay for other things that we don't get the money for. So I think I saw it was about one of these estimates were about $4 million it would cost, excuse me, to pass this bill.
Follow-up, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So $4 million, we think, is the fiscal note. And then just a broader question, since this is my first term on health and human services or housing, there's a lot of discussion about living on $437 a month, and I can see where that would be extremely problematic, especially with children. But my question is, I need a broader view of other types of programs like, you know, child care assistance or heating assistance or housing assistance or food stamps or medical assistance to get a more of an overview of what the need is here. You know, I'm not real sure at this point what the 437 of cash assistance needs to supply.
Senator Eaton, would you respond? I think this is an important conversation. Please, everyone, I think the committee needs to understand this is what my earlier question was about. As other resources are made available, like rental assistance, how does it impact what is accessible in terms of this MFIP grant? That's what Senator Nelson is asking again, and if there's someone that can help articulate that, if there's someone from the department here that would like to do that, we'd be very appreciative. Is there somebody from the department here?
We have just about everybody wants to respond to that.
The response that we're looking for, though, is just factual. It's sort of understanding what it is that is the accumulative impact of other programs that are, you know, child care and maybe transportation costs, and if they get a housing voucher, they're so likely to get on Section 8. How does it impact this? Is that correct, Senator Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think we need an overall view of how this particular bill fits into all of the other aspects that are needed in raising a family.
I understand. Madam Chair,
Senator Eaton.
I can speak from my experience working as a community mental health nurse, and I will tell you that the waiting list is so long that most children will be in high school before they get the daycare funding. I think it's 3 or 3 to 5 years now to get a housing subsidy, if you can even get registered in the small amount of time that they open the grant.
It's not even open anymore.
Oh, it's not even open anymore to get on the list in Hennepin and Ramsey. So the problem is that everybody, all these grants are being decreased, discontinued, or frozen, and they're all counting on each other, but nobody's keeping up.
I see Jane DeLage from the department in the back of the room. I'd like to ask her to come forward. I think that what we're seeking is a department answer on this question.
Hello, my name is Jane DeLage, and I work with the MFIP program for the Department of Human Services. The question about what happens if you get a rental subsidy, we do count $50 of the rental amount toward the grant. That reduces the grant. Anything beyond that is not counted. As far as childcare is one of the things that if you're on the MFIP program, you are entitled to the childcare under the Child Care Assistance Program. And that is available to people who are working. As far as some of these additional programs, I think it's very important to note that they're not available to everyone. We can't meet current need with housing assistance. We can't meet current need with the heating assistance. There are some people who do receive those types of assistance, and we don't count the heating assistance against the grant. We have many people who have to apply for emergency assistance to be able to avoid eviction and to pay for their utilities and that sort of thing. So the grant clearly is the only cash that families have to cover most of their expenses other than food and child care. They are also eligible for medical assistance for the most part. So all of the things that you need that are not food or child care or medical pretty much have to come out of that small amount of cash.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Eaton.
I just wanted to reiterate that the waiting list for child care is so long it's in effect not available. I don't know of anybody who actually gets it.
Thank you.
May I speak?
Yes, Ms. DeLage.
Jane DeLage, the child care for MFIP is not part of the basic sliding fee. And so is eligible. So families who are on MFIP, it's a forecasted child care program, so they are eligible. Now, if you exit or anyone who's beyond the grant, there's different qualifications there. There's a transitional year, and they're generally allowed onto basic sliding fee as well. But it is true that for many low-income families who are not eligible for MFIP, child care is not readily available. There are waiting lists in many places. But for the MFIT program, there is a forecasted program, and they are eligible.
Okay, thank you. I think that the bottom line that we're saying here is that there's this MFIT program. There are some people, and not certainly huge waiting lists, but there are some people that will get a renter's program, a rent program that assists them with housing, and then they get a $50 credit for that. And if they have, if they're able to find...
It's not deduction.
A deduction for that. But that's substantially a benefit. I'm not saying it's a great benefit, but it's a benefit as opposed to somebody who's not able to get a housing voucher. So there is a higher stress for those who are on waiting lists trying to get housing vouchers to help improve their living situation, as opposed to someone that was fortunate enough to access that. And the child care assistance only occurs if somebody is working, and it is a program to support the concept of moving people into the workforce and eventually building their independence. It's not about being able to pay for essential living expenses to maintain the household. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'll divulge me, I have two questions, one comment, and then an action I'd like to see happen. So, and I'm glad the department's here. I was looking around. Where's the department? MFIP, are we still around 45 or 48% of the participants in MFIP either have a disability or have a child with a disability?
I'm not
Ms. DeLage.
Yes, this is Jane DeLage at the Department of Human Services, and I'm not sure if that exactly is the ratio. We have about a third of our caseload now in what is called family stabilization services. Some of those families are there with mental health or physical health issues, and we also have a large number of families now that are child-only cases where the parent is on supplemental security income, but there's a large percentage.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman?
In 2005, the Child Care Developmental Block Grant, Minnesota left $90 million on the table, and that specifically affected kids with disabilities and kids that were taken, were utilizing those child care centers that had special needs. And Ramsey County had one that was really affected by the change some outcomes for families. And so as I look at this, so the answer is it probably still is around 45 or 48%, but I would like to get some clarification on that, and that specifically is regarding those individuals and also if they have a family member themselves. But to see 27% of the TANF money, I would be curious, and this is just I'd like to see this report, Madam Chair, if I could, where's the rest of that money going? I mean, it's 27% of it's supposed to be earmarked for the old AFDC program or now temporary assistance for needy families. I'd like to see the department give me a report on where that money's, where it's going to, and what's it affecting specifically for children and youth in our community. So is that something the department can give, Madam Chair?
I am sure we can ask for a report on that. And if you can give us a 50,000-foot explanation for how this money is going at this time, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's good. 50,000 feet is perfect. Yep.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, my name is Jane DeLage from Department of Human Services, and I can tell you some of the categories of expenditures that are taken from the TANF grant. A chunk of the money goes to the Working Family Credit. A chunk of that money goes to employment services to support the employment services that are part of the program. Some of the money goes to emergency assistance, as I mentioned prior to this. So those are some of the big categories. Some of it goes to the Department of Health for pregnancy prevention and related issues. So those are some of the major categories that the money goes to.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. And the pregnancy prevention, my assumption there is they're also wrapping some Title V federal dollars into that as well. So I'd like to actually see, as long as she's on that prospect, really get a little deeper down on the 50,000-mile mark and get some more information on just how our funds are being spent in Minnesota.
Can you respond to that in the next few days?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Senator Hoffman, certainly we can get you some additional information on where the TANF funding goes.
And would you share that with all the members of this committee? Or you can have it sent to my committee administrator and she would distribute it.
Senator Sharon, Senator Hoffman, certainly I can do that.
Thank you very much. Any other questions in the committee?
Madam Chair, we'd like to add a little bit of information here.
Just about the...
Repeat your name.
Oh, sorry.
Ms. My name Beecher?
Is Angel Buchner.
Buchner.
Just to add a thing about the public housing assistance. It charges us 30% of our income. So that's like, you know, after that $50 is deducted, they still, you know, it's a 30% disregard of our income. So it's kind of not a wash, so it's taking more money. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that, how, you know, if a person is lucky enough to get subsidized housing, how that still impacts if that $50 is taken out of that grant, you know, because they charge us 30% of our income.
Thank you. I'd appreciate an articulation of that as well, because I think that's what Senator Nelson is looking for, is an understanding of how it sounds like, you know, if you get housing vouchers, gee, that really solves the problem. But what you're describing is that how that's treated in relationship to the MFIP grant needs to be understood more comprehensively. Senator Eaton?
Madam Chair, I'd also like to reiterate that if you do get up to about $750 an hour, you no longer qualify for MFIP, but you make too much money for most other programs. Yeah. So you've lost your daycare, your cash assistance, food, school lunch.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eaton, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and to those on the committee. I think that this is a really good, robust discussion about what we've been doing with the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And I think that there are a ton of questions that still have yet to be answered. And so I hope that this bill continues to travel. But in its next step, I think we really need, Senator Eaton, to be frank with you, a much thorough understanding of the program. There are a lot of moving parts in this program. So there is issues of if you get a housing voucher of many different ways, what that costs, 30% of your income, the $50 that's taken away. There are issues around sliding scale versus child care if you're on the program. There's issues about, you know, kind of where the lines are for free and reduced lunch and where that stops and where it starts. There's issues of what the department, I think they need to come forward and as we talk about this, about what their plans are moving forward around work and what they want to do in the waivers that they put forward that gets people out of poverty and so that they are able to get the skills necessary to move forward, as opposed to the game that's being played today where people have these work-like duties that they walk around and they're not able to get the jobs that they need. I think we could talk about how we don't have enough public housing and what we have is substandard. I think we could talk about homelessness and long-term homelessness. So what I would like is that, as opposed to we just look at this as, and I do think that the cash portion is woefully substandard and that we haven't changed it since 1986. We haven't even attached it to a cost of living, regardless to what you feel about these programs. I think that we need to do a deeper dive, as Senator Hoffman has said, about what this program's intended purpose is, what it does, what are the available, as Senator Nelson has talked about, what are the available resources to low-income families, how do they interact with our CAP agencies and others, how much money are we actually giving out, and I think that that would be helpful to really kind of do a deeper dive to understand what is going on with families in Minnesota. Otherwise, I think it falls into this camp of one group thinking that they're getting a lot and another group groans and says we're getting nothing. And so I would hope that, Senator Eaton, as this bill continues to travel, that we actually work really, really close to understand the ins and outs of this program, that we work with the department to really know kind of how this is working, and then we really can, in a comprehensive way, really talk about what are we doing with this population? Where should people be going? How do they get out of it? And if they are permanently disabled, what are the things in which we need to do in order for them to get the resources that they need to live a high-quality life? I think that that's really important. Otherwise, I think that there has been a ton of things that have been swirling around. And Madam Chair and most of the committee members know that I've worked on this a long time, and I think that we're not quite a foot of what we need to do here. And Senator Eaton, I think we have to continue to do that if we're going to make the case, even to the extent of what this is going to cost. I don't know if that has been talked about, and we're going to get a fiscal note on it. And I think it might be worth the cost, but we should talk about what it's going to cost. And as Senator Nelson asked, and I think it's important, even though I think we should spend the money, we should say where it comes from and where do we get it. We should talk about the refinancing of MFIB dollars or TANF funds into the general funds over the years. It's not just the categories that we've put it in to help people. There's a lot to talk about here, and I hope that if we do get this bill through and we get to Senator Lori's committee, that we have a thoughtful and thorough conversation, because I don't think we've had that today yet.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Any further discussion? Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just make a couple comments. And first, I want to apologize for not answering your question when you first asked me at the beginning of the hearing. And I wish that I would have provided a broader overview of the MFIT program, because I think it would have been helpful. And so, in just briefly, I just want to make two points. And one, so we've already heard from the department and we've heard in testimony about the different components of MFIT, but just to reiterate that you have to have a child, that you already have to be living in poverty to be eligible for MFIT. We talked about that transitional standard, that there's the food portion, there's the cash portion, and that this bill is focusing on that cash portion piece. And I think because of that, that's why testimony and discussion was really tailored to that piece rather than providing all the different puzzle pieces that really form the MFIT program. And I also want to share, too, that there was a discussion on the child care component, that basic sliding fee is separate from MFIP, that there's a child care component while you're receiving MFIP if you are in one of the approved work activities, and then there's the transitional year after you are exiting the MFIP program. So they're the, so you have the MFIP piece, and then you have the basic sliding fee. I also wanted to share that the exit level for MFIP is 115% of the federal poverty level, but that, again, when we're talking about cash, which is the focus of this bill, that families lose cash at about 70% of federal poverty. So it's the food, it's the services that remain. We heard reference to sanctions, that families are sanctioned for different activities, for not complying with certain requirements, and that a sanction comes with also reducing the grant. I want to clarify a piece, too, also as to the housing, that two-thirds of families, so when Ms. Buchner was talking about all the different pieces, all the different things that families need to pay for with the cash, that in addition to the list of, and I don't want to go through because it was such a comprehensive list, but that two-thirds of families do have to pay for housing with that cash grant in addition to the list that Ms. Buchner provided. And then the last piece that I wanted to share, since, again, the focus is on cash, that right now the current grant is $1,005 for a family of three, which is the average family size receiving MFIP, $532 for cash, $473 for food. This bill then looks at specifically of increasing that grant to $1,064 in cash. As far as the fiscal note, you heard reference to a $4 million fiscal note. That's for the family cap repeal. As far as what this fiscal note is, I can't speak to that, but I know it's more than $4 million. And the last piece that I'd like to offer is that one of the pieces that we do at Children's Defense Fund is we have the Bridge to Benefits program, which is an online tool that helps connect families with different programs and tax credits. With that, we have what's called an economic stability indicator that can actually look at different programs and how they interact. I know the committee's time is well accounted for already with deadlines coming up, but that we could run through a simulation so you can see at the different wage levels. There was reference made to the 750, our current federal minimum wage is 725, but we can walk through what in income, what a different wage level looks like and what programs families are eligible for. So we can look at MFIP. We can look at, as a family's leaving MFIP, after that year, we can look at food, we can look at health care, we can look at energy assistance, we can look at WIC, we can look at the different tax credits and show you that picture of what it looks like for a family and what their economic situation looks like. So I do want to offer that for the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. I think that would be very interesting, and I don't know whether or not Senator Loy will be doing that in his committee. He looks like he's nodding his head up and down, yes, but clearly, you know, I know that comprehensive examination of this may take more than just the next few weeks we have. But I don't think we want to lose sight of this, and even after policy deadlines are over, if we still have committee time, that we can dive in more deeply to some of these things, and if we aren't able to resolve these issues completely in one session, we certainly can move forward in the future session. So is that adequate response to you, Senator Hayden? Any further discussion on Senate file?
Madam Chair?
165, yes.
I just want to say that there's a ton of things that have to be fixed with the system. And we've been talking to hundreds and hundreds of people on the street, and this is the one that just shocks folks. 27 years without an increase. 1986, that increase was just a 2% increase. I mean, I just want to keep coming back to that, because to me that's fundamental to this. You know, the best way out of poverty is money. Hello. And so we're taking the simplest bill and trying to make it work.
Well, thank you. No, you cannot do that. You cannot do that. You cannot speak from without coming to the table. I would like to thank you all for coming to testify. I want you to know that I understand that while there is very broad discussions about the overall system and how it needs to be modified and changed, it's like redesigning a fire system. If there's a fire over here that's burning and is just being very destructive, we shouldn't necessarily wait until the whole system is resolved to try to address an immediate fire. So I don't think anybody here is saying we aren't going to address some components of it simply because we haven't quite got our arms around the whole system. But we are saying we need to get our arms around this whole system. So with that, thank you very much. Senator Eaton renews her motion to pass Senate File 165 and refer it to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. And I have one announcement before you leave. We will recess to the call of the chair. We expect to return around 6 p.m., but we will keep you updated, so please pay attention to your email communications. Thank you.